I support eco-justice just because the law is how we can really create long-term change for the environment.
Welcome to the Just Because podcast. In a space in which the scarcity mindset has been normal for far too long, discover how we're helping nonprofits finally take back their power, find their true purpose, and even use mindfulness to manifest their dream solutions into reality. I'm your host, Catherine Lacefield, a lifetime nonprofit professional. Together, we'll master the tools needed to overcome limitations, rise in times of adversity, and understand the interconnectedness of all causes towards a more conscious philanthropy, just because it's the right thing to do.
Hi, Tess. Thank you so much for joining me on the Just Because podcast today. We're going to be talking about environmental justice, environmental philanthropy, and of course, the very important role of legacy giving. And I'm very excited to have you on today.
Hi, Catherine. Well, I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. So first, as much as we've been talking for quite a few months now, I'd love for you to just take the time to kind of present a bit of your background, how you got into the environmental movement and into fundraising and philanthropy in general.
Absolutely. So I am a professional fundraiser. I've been doing this for over 8 years now. It's pretty much been my entire career, and I'm a CFRE. And I got into fundraising because of my work in social justice spaces that included environmental justice. So I was a student in my last year of university, and I really needed a job. And at the same time, I was volunteering with some advocacy groups in Edmonton, which is where I'm from. And I would say in Edmonton, we had to like really band together for these groups because we didn't have a lot of us. So my friend was doing face-to-face canvassing for charities. And I said to him, hey, I think I could do that. Do you guys have a job for me? And they said, absolutely. And I really took a liking to it, and I was very good at it. And from there, I launched my career and pursued formal education and fundraising as well. So I guess when I got involved with the environmental movement, it was always an intersectional part of my advocacy. Because in Edmonton, we had like all of us together. So we would organize an environmental rally, and then we would organize the Fight for 15 rally to increase the minimum wage. And then we would be talking about food security. So for me, I've always seen it as part of a larger conversation about justice in general.
It's funny because my first like official fundraising job was also in face-to-face canvassing. And I always, when people ask like, oh, so how did you get involved? I'm like, you know, those annoying people on the streets that are like, hey, do you want to learn? Well, that was me. So I very much feel that it's a very tough job. But for anyone who's like kind of has that advocacy part, like I feel like that's the more front-facing advocacy fundraising style that I personally really enjoyed. I'm sure we could talk for hours about all the stories of the crazy stuff I heard walking on the streets, but it brings up a very important point when you're talking about intersectionality and the different connection between causes. I remember when I was working on the streets, I was mostly doing animal rights at the time, and I've had people stop and I had this man literally spit at me and say, how dare you protect the animal, like animals, when there's children in Syria dying or that there's these wars affecting humans. And what I really liked what you said is that you guys were kind of ganging together around advocacy groups, around justice, be it for environment, for people. So how do you see the connection between all these different justice issues? I'd be really interested in hearing your thoughts on that.
Absolutely. When I had those kinds of interactions, when I was canvassing, that would always break my heart because it's never either or, right? And just because you support one cause doesn't exclude your support of another. So I see the environment as intersecting with all forms of justice. I mean, there is a lot of value in protecting the environment for the sake of the environment. But I think part of the reason why it's so important to protect it is because of the people and the animals that rely on it. And it's often the most marginalized people that are going to have the most negative impacts of pollution, of climate change. And it's the wealthiest people who are benefiting from environmental degradation that are also going to be protected from those impacts. So it's completely related. And, you know, like if you care about food security, whether locally or globally, the climate's a really important part of that as just one example.
No, that's perfect. And that's exactly, I think, what a lot of people fail to see. Like when people talk about like, how could you care about like animals? And I'm like, well, let's say biodiversity. If we don't have a biodiverse world, our entire ecosystem could collapse. And like our food systems depend on biodiversity, our pollinizers, like everything is so interconnected that even if you really want it to be very anthropocentric and think of, I just care about humans, well, you still need to care about the environment or else kind of screwed. Like, we depend on the environment for our survival. So I think that's something that is very much missing in like philanthropy discourse around different causes, of separating it into like health causes, environment. We make these such neat little categories, but at the end of the day, they're all connected. And I think that's something that's very much missing, from my experience at least, in working in philanthropy. So at EcoJustice, I know you were working there and you were working in more legacy giving, if yes. That's what I understand correctly. So how did you get to working there specifically? How did that come about?
Well, similar to how I found fundraising in general, I needed a job and I had a connection who was working at EcoJustice, and I was really interested in starting a job related to philanthropy, either in major giving or planned giving. I wanted to do more of that one-on-one relationship management style of fundraising. And so it came up, and because of my work in environmental advocacy, it was a really great fit. And it went from there. I didn't know anything about legacy giving before I started, but I was able to learn it all on the job and ran a pretty successful program.
I find it crazy how so many fundraisers that I've talked to have fell into fundraising and learned through the work. And so there's a great value in learning from experience instead of just formal education of being trained. I know now there's a lot more training opportunities for fundraisers. I don't think there was as many. Like, when I started in fundraising, there was at least one program in Montreal, and they just closed it down. But there's a lot less formal education around fundraising, which I find crazy because there's so many nonprofits in the country that are dependent on fundraising. But anyways, that's this conversation for another day. From having worked in both the advocacy, have worked with different organizations and working at EcoJustice in particular, but what do you see as some of the biggest challenges for the environmental movement that you've been faced with, either as a fundraiser or just working in the space in general? What are some of the biggest challenges?
Besides the systemic challenges that is facing environmental justice overall and environmental causes getting less funding systemically than other causes, I would say that I also had a bit of a challenge in dealing with some donors and supporters and getting them to understand how the environment intersects with a lot of social issues. And especially when we started working with more Indigenous groups and providing them more support, even outside of some environmental advocacy, we got some pushback from them, and we had to kind of talk to them about the importance of why these issues intersect and why this is still really connected to EcoJustice's mission.
It's interesting because I find that when you talk to people who care about humans, you almost have to convince them that taking care of the environment is also important. And then the opposite, when you have these diehard environmentalists, you're like, yes, but we also have to take care of the humans. They're like, oh no, but I just want to protect the nature. So I find it interesting how it's almost like opposing situations. And so do you have like maybe a specific example of like a tough conversation you had to have around that with a donor, around that, you know, taking care of more of the social justice aspect of in working in the environment?
Yeah, I do have a lot of examples. And I do want to preface this by saying the donors I worked with were absolutely amazing. Like, a privilege of working in legacy giving in the environmental sector is you meet people who were chaining themselves to trees in the 60s and 70s, and they really care about the environment and they care about people and justice in general. The thing that I found is they mostly just didn't have the context or the education to really understand it from the intersectional lens, because that is fairly new in the discourse. So the most common challenging conversation I would have with donors is around the issue of overpopulation, which really is baked into white supremacy, right? Because often when we talk about overpopulation, we're talking about, you know, the others. There's other people that shouldn't be having children, not necessarily mm-hmm. me. So I would have a chance to talk to them about that. And there's a lot of actually like science about how overpopulation isn't even an issue. There's a really great resource that's called overpopulation.org that analyzes some of that. But then there's also the issues of how many resources people are taking up, right? Like, you know, a mother in Niger with 8 children is probably taking up less resources than a family of 4 in Canada. Mm-hmm. So I usually found that when I had these conversations with donors, they wouldn't immediately be like, oh, you're right. But they would just be like, oh, huh. And then they would go off and think about it. And I think that's so important, because we all have different journeys when it comes to fighting for justice and being an advocate. For myself, I didn't show up to social justice spaces like being a intersectional advocate. I was really passionate about poverty reduction because I grew up in poverty, and feminism because I'm a woman. I knew that racism was kind of a thing and the environment was important, but it wasn't until I had more conversations with people about these issues and understood the magnitude of the problems and how it influences our everyday lives and how it's baked into systems and systemic oppression that I was able to develop the mindset that I have now.
And I think having that openness, like in fundraising, even myself, when I'm talking with one-on-one with donors, we have these opportunities to learn both ways. And sometimes like same thing for me, it was like always the environment. All other causes was like, of course I know that they're important. I just don't know enough about them to understand why. So you kind of have to, with time, everyone will be at a different step on their journey of understanding a certain cause or an issue. And I don't think we can all become experts in every single issue. I don't think that's realistic, but it's by each kind of doing our own part to educate each other and to learn from each other that we can get people to move forward. So like you were saying, having that conversation probably planted a seed in that donor's mind to be like, oh, like I hadn't thought of it that way. And then maybe they'll on their own start thinking about it. And then who knows, maybe down the line, they'll become their most fervent defender of that same idea. And I know that you are working mostly with legacy gifts. So how do you feel that legacy? Because I have never done legacy gift giving. That's really out of my expertise. And so I'd love to hear your thoughts on what's special about working in the legacy gift space, especially within the environmental. So you were talking about, people chaining themselves to the tree. So talk a bit about like, what's been more specific about that?
Absolutely. Well, the really special thing about legacy gift fundraising in general is that when someone actually decides to leave a gift in their will to a charity, it's because that charity aligns with their deepest life values. Like your will is essentially a document that reflects what you valued in your life. And that's really cool. So you get to talk to donors about their stories and hear about them chaining themselves to trees and everything like that. And the environment has a lot of opportunity for legacy giving, particularly because when we think of protecting the environment, not only are you reflecting on your past experience in the environment, maybe you weren't a diehard activist in the 70s, but even just those times when you're going off to the cabin with your parents as a child and running around the woods and the lake. And so that's part of your life's narrative. So as the environmental cause, we have a lot to work with there in terms of bringing that to a legacy gift. And the other thing is that when we think about protecting the environment, we're often already thinking about the future and what we're leaving behind. There was also this really interesting idea that I heard Paul Nazareth of the CAGP say, where the environment is almost replacing religion for a lot of people in countries like Canada and the USA that are going away from churches. You know, I think about on the West Coast where I live, we have a forest that's actually called Cathedral Forest. And there's those giant, giant trees. Like when you see a picture of a tiny human with a giant tree, that's where it is. And it's a cathedral, right? It's a place where people can now go for reflection, for contemplation, and start to feel like there's something bigger is the environment. So there's tons of opportunity for legacy giving in our sector.
There's like that connection between the environment as also a source of spirituality. I think that we live more and more in this very scientific, rational world, but I think everyone will kind of crave something that goes beyond that. And the environment might become that new haven where people can go and just still have that sense of wonder of like not necessarily understanding how everything works and that we feel like we need to respect it, but we don't necessarily understand its power as well. Like there's definitely a lot of parallels between the religion. I really like what you also said about kind of the nostalgic aspect. Like the timeline for caring about the environment is so long. We think about nice like childhood memories of being in the forest or at the beach, like a lot of natural like experiences. And also the future generations of, we want our children or our grandchildren to have access to those same kinds of, to that same environment, the same privileges that we had as children. So yeah, the timeline is very interesting for the environment as opposed to, I'm not going to compare it to many other causes, but I'm just trying to think like, I feel like there's a much more lasting emotional attachment to that cause.
Yes.
That's very special in the environmental movement.
Absolutely. And that makes it a prime audience for legacy giving.
So speaking of legacy giving, so for my understanding is that a lot of environmental organizations are more new. There's a lot of smaller grassroots organizations that are kind of starting to pick up. They've been around for maybe a couple of years. And I think legacy giving, in my opinion, has always been this thing like, oh, you start that when you've been established forever, when you have a huge list of donors. And so I wouldn't even know how to start a legacy giving program. So maybe we can start talking about that of kind of when would a nonprofit even start considering a legacy gift program?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is some truth to what you said. you don't want to start a legacy giving program if you're a brand new nonprofit that's only been around for 1 or 2 years, because you do need to develop that trust with your donors that you're going to be around for a while. And you also need donors to have a chance to be giving for a little while and build up that connection to your cause. I would say a really great mark to do a lot of legacy fundraising is when you've been around for 10 years. However, even as young as 5 years, it would be a good idea to maybe think about this as an area of fundraising for you. And so in terms of the next steps of what you can do to actually start a legacy giving program, I would say the first one is find your why. And we say that so much in the nonprofit sector, but it's really important that you have your why outside of program specific support, because a lot of nonprofits were applying for grants and you focus on the one program at a time. But when it comes to legacy giving, it's usually a lot of unrestricted gifts, or if they're restricted really broadly, because we don't necessarily know what our priorities are going to be in 20, 30 years down the line. So you need to be able to really clearly articulate that. The next thing that you can do is think about having some legacy messaging dripped throughout your regular donor communication. So you don't need to do anything special, like super complicated or special or over the top. Just, you know, if you have someone who's already left a gift in their will, share their story or talk about that why and talk about why legacy giving is important, and do that a few times a year just to get it in people's minds that, you know, legacy giving is an option. It might be something you want to consider, because it does take a really long time to consider a legacy gift.
I'm going to just pause there for a second, because I had a client recently and we were talking about legacy giving. And I think I gave you this example as well, where in their annual campaign, they added this little checkbox of like, would you like to know about our legacy giving program? And I found that was very like, who's going to want to think, like, I found it was a bit too direct. Like, how do you feel about that kind of a strategy?
I think checkboxes are actually extremely effective to get people to raise their hands that they're interested in a legacy gift, so you can talk with them about it, or even confirm that they've left a gift in their will, so you can then thank them and steward them for the rest of their lives. However, I think you need to think about putting some legacy giving messages in some of your donor communications beforehand to prime the audience a little more would be ideal.
Yeah. So giving them more information before that, hey, this exists, because this was they had no program whatsoever. They're kind of just testing the waters. But so I'm guessing their donors are just like, where's this coming from? Like, I don't even know. Like, did people even know what a legacy giving program might mean? It might be like, I don't know, it might be a bit too much for them.
Yeah. I mean, even in that newsletter, like if you feature a donor, a legacy giving donor story, and then you put that checkbox in, even if it's the first time you show that story, I think that's a great way to prime the audience. But You bring up a good point about language, because it's true. A lot of donors don't know what a legacy gift is. And when it comes to planned giving, that sounds so technical, it usually just go over their heads, which is why when you're communicating with donors about this, the best thing to say is leave a gift in your will, because that is clear to understand.
Mm-hmm. Okay. First step, start talking about it, getting people warmed up to the idea, getting them to know what you mean by a legacy gift, kind of setting the stage for like the frame. What would be like a next step that a nonprofit could take on?
Then you could move into a more active legacy giving program. And I think an important part of that is, first of all, tracking your donors properly in your database that they've left a legacy gift to you, because especially, you know, when they have made that commitment, you want to keep stewarding them. And then you can look at ways you can start actively soliciting for the legacy gifts. Before you even think about doing the checkboxes, make sure that you have a plan to follow up with donors who check that checkbox. It could be as simple as a phone call and then like an email or letter. But to move beyond that, I would encourage you to think about creating a why brochure, which is basically your case for support for legacy giving.
So in this case for support, because I've dabbled a bit in planned giving, I know that there's many different ways, and I don't want to go too deep down the rabbit hole of planned giving, because I know that there's many different ways. And like you say, sometimes it's just easier to just say, leave us in your will. But would you think that that's a very important step that as an organization, they need to start exploring all of the different ways? Or do you feel that we should go simple first? Like, kind of what would be your initial advice to an organization?
I would say, especially for small nonprofits, just go simple to start. So you don't need the full case and brochure. You can just put a few of those legacy messaging in your communication and then add a checkbox and create a plan that everyone checks that box is going to get a phone call. That's a great way to start.
Yeah, because I feel like a lot of times there's this chicken or the egg thing of being scared to start without knowing too much information, but then being so bogged down by information that you're never ready enough to start the program, especially when you know that you might not get any gifts for 5 years down the line. Like, I feel like it can be really tough to like get that program started.
Yeah, it can be, which is why I would encourage nonprofits who are considering this to just try it out with that drip marketing messaging. So what it's called drip marketing is when you sprinkle the little messages in throughout your communication, because it does take about 2 to 5 years for someone to think about leaving a gift in their will to actually leaving a gift in their will. So even if you just have that messaging sprinkled in, that'll help them think about it, even if you aren't doing anything more than that.
Would you say that there's anything specific, so let's say for environmental organizations, like any key messages that you feel from your experience working with legacy donors, that there's any key messages that really touch them more around or inspire them to be part of the legacy program?
I can't say there's any one message, especially because there's so many different types of environmental causes. Like a hardcore advocacy cause will have a different message than just a nature trust. However, one thing that works well in legacy messaging in general is connecting to a donor's life story. It's the idea of the hero's journey. Russell James has really great literature on this as well, and kind of like what goes on in people's brains when they're making a legacy giving decision. So messaging around like, you know, if a donor is telling their story about why they left a gift in their will, getting them to talk a little bit about how they remember going to the lake as a kid. And then when they were a teenager, they started, you know, learning about plants or whatever that story is, because then a donor who has a similar life story will tap into that narrative and then they see themselves in it and they'll start thinking about a legacy gift.
Is there, from your work at EcoJustice, can you remember a donor, obviously without necessarily saying their name, but do you have a story that you remember to this day of being like a very inspiring donor story around legacy giving?
I would say the donor who chained themselves to the trees in like the 60s and 70s, because that is just amazing, right? I think when we think of boomers, we can think, oh, they're so conservative, but that's not true. And definitely not a monolith. And they're the ones who paved the way to be where we are today.
It's true. No, I definitely love that, the idea of like that diehard hippie that screw the government. I don't want any of my like inheritance money going in taxes. Like I'm going to donate it to an organization. Like that's how I can see these like, and they obviously have tattoos and long hair. Like, I could totally stereotypical, but that's how I envision these people. And I find that's like, yeah, you go grandpa. Like for me, that's such an inspiring story of kind of counterbalancing. I feel a lot of the eco anxiety that I think a lot of young people are feeling now of the older generations kind of screwed it up and that they're now facing, and they're like, oh, well, we're the only ones responsible for taking care of that next generation. Like it's all on the shoulders of youth. But then this is an opportunity for these older generations to start thinking of like how they can not necessarily repair like in that sense directly, but how they can help support the next generation by in their legacy, giving that extra support. So I feel like that's a really cool, like intergenerational way of seeing it. That can be a different way of giving back when maybe they didn't have the knowledge in the past, but now that they do, it's a great way of kind of like moving forward for the next generation.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be a really cool donor story. I've never actually met a donor like that before. Typically, they're people who've like been into the environment and protecting the environment for their whole lives. But there could totally be someone like that too. You just have to talk to your donors and get to know their stories.
Mm-hmm. It all comes down to storytelling. I feel like fundraising in general really is all around sharing those donor stories. And I really like what you said about starting to share the legacy gift stories, because I hadn't thought of that. Often we talk about like donors while they're living because you want to give them recognition and all these things. And of course, like they might have made a promise for a legacy gift while they're still living and taking that opportunity. Because I think personally, whenever I hear about legacy giving, I'm like, oh, we're going to be talking about when they die. Like that's kind of scary. And the way I'm seeing it now is more, no, you're focusing on how they lived.
Yeah, absolutely. A legacy gift really is about someone's life values and life stories and how it's going to continue living on. It's not about death.
It's definitely a different perspective. I think that can help people kind of see legacy and planned giving in a much different light. So Tess, this is kind of what you do. So if someone were, let's say, thinking about this is the kind of work that you offer, like what do you offer as services to nonprofits to help them either within this or within other fundraising needs? Like how would people get to know and how would they be able to work with you?
Yeah, so you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm most active there, Tess Conrad, CFRE, and my website is fullpotentialfundraising.com. I'm a fractional fundraiser, which means I work with small nonprofits. I kind of as a part-time development director. I create a high-level fundraising plan, and then I also implement that plan. So it's best of both worlds of getting an expert consultant and also the boots on the ground implementation. And I'll do that for legacy giving programs specifically as well. So feel free to get in touch with me if you want to learn more about that.
Awesome. Thank you so much. So I'll of course be adding all of these links and how to connect with Tess directly in the show notes. And she mentioned some really great resources that I'll also put in the show notes if ever you guys want to dig in deeper. If not, so far, like, I've been having such a great conversation. I've learned so much already about legacy giving. And I know that knowing even just those little three steps kind of makes it a lot easier to understand how we can start, even if we're not ready to accept it now, just talking about it. And it doesn't have to be this big, scary thing that we have to have all in place with lawyers and paperwork and policies, that you can just kind of start small and see as things grow how it goes. So thank you so much for sharing all this amazing information. It was super useful. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to the Just Because podcast. Are you enjoying the content we're creating? We'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback. Thanks for leaving us your wonderful review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and hitting that subscribe button to have access to new episodes as soon as they drop. All of our affiliate partners are hand-selected to offer you only tried, tested, and true tools to give your organization the absolute best. Signing up to any of them using our code or link directly supports the podcast and is a great way to say thank you without any extra cost for you. Thanks for being part of the community,